So we see a combination of ideas here. Some strictly scientific, the idea of the atom. Some logos, nous, proportion, measure, divine intelligence, almost moving into the philosophical and theological realm. One of the very important features for the subsequent course of writing in the Western tradition is the fact that the Ionian Revolution, this philosophical revolution, tended to use prose rather than poetry as the language in which ideas were expressed. Poetry, increasingly from now on, would come to be associated only with tomithodes, that mythical element we've talked about in previous lectures, stories, fiction, lyric poetry, epic poetry. While prose would come to be the language of inquiry, whether it be philosophical, ethical inquiry, whether it be historical inquiry, what have you. And the term used here by the Greeks to connote this notion of prose and investigation, trying to work out underlying laws behind phenomena, was logos. It's a word that in Greek can mean both speech, a speech act, logos, word, but it also comes to mean scientific inquiry as well. So it's from that range of meanings that we derive our English use of the term logic, that is to say, the investigation of rational thinking. For many of these pre-Socratic philosophers, the physical world which they investigated was really only a reflection of a much deeper fundamental and underlying reality. And in this sense, one of the features or one of the themes that one finds running through the pre-Socratic philosophers and down into the philosophy of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle as well, is a problem about the reliability of the senses. And this is still a standard of most philosophical systems. The senses are unreliable. You've all seen the basic trick of taking a beaker full of water, putting a ruler inside it, and seeing that it seems to bend. Now, of course, it doesn't, but our senses, our visual senses, can be tricked into thinking that it bends. Proceeding from that kind of observation, namely that the senses are untrustworthy, the pre-Socratics formulated the notion that the senses really can only give rise to what they called gnome, opinion. You think that a phenomenon is so because you observe it to be so. But in fact, if there is a true underlying reality to the world, it may lie beyond our immediate sensual apprehension. And that knowledge, that understanding of the underlying world, not tricked by the senses, is what they call episteme, knowledge, from which we get our English term epistemology, the investigation of how we know what we know. True episteme comes about only after gnome, opinions, have been overturned, surmounted. So the aim of Greek philosophy as a result of this basic understanding was to achieve a clearer grasp of the world by distinguishing between its external reality and its underlying reality. And that's what drives the Greek philosophers, the attempt to do away with externals and to get to the core underneath. Now, that common enterprise of the philosophers then leads to a very close connection between what we would call the natural sciences, observing nature, geometry, geography, biology, and so forth, based on observation of the world, and then moral philosophy that asks the question, how should I live in the world? How should I behave? So many of the distinctions that we draw between different aspects of science, philosophy, theology, and so forth are distinctions that really don't make sense when looking at Greek philosophy. It is a combination of many of these things. Now, that is going to be one of the great traditions that leads into Socratic philosophy. But there is a whole second one that I have to chart in addition to that, and that is the tradition known as sophistry or sophistic learning. Along with the scientific revolution that I've been outlining, the 5th century also witnessed the rise of a new class of teachers. Not just philosophers, but men who actually taught classes and were paid for this, professional educators. And they're known as sophists.